This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Petro-masculinity.
True fact. Countries led by women control the COVID-19 pandemic far better than nations led by men. Try New Zealand and the United States. Would that be true for climate action too? Is our idea of manhood a barrier to dumping dangerous fossil fuels? Is that why authoritarians are trying to take over? Welcome to Petro-masculinity and the renewed call for woman power to help us get out of these converging crises. Minds open and prepare for change. Two eco-feminist scholars and authors join us on Radio EcoShock. From the United States through Europe to Australia, there is a growing attraction for authoritarian government. Let a big leader solve it all. And despite what you think, this urge may become stronger as climate change drives more extreme weather into our lives. The regression from democracy is powered by denial of science, medical science during a pandemic, and climate science during a climate emergency. Why is this happening? It is time to talk with Kara Daggett. She, in 2018, published Petro-Masculinity, Fossil Fuels and Authoritarian Desire. It is all about what is really happening today. Dr. Daggett is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Virginia Tech. She is a feminist researcher into political ecology and author of the new book, The Birth of Energy. From Washington, D.C., Kara Daggett, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Why don't we dive right in? Please introduce us to what you mean by petro-masculinity.
Sure. That is a term where I'm trying to think about how fossil fuels are not just important to the economy or to people in terms of economic interests, and not just important in terms of raw material power, but also important to people's identities. So trying to understand how people are attached to them in that way because they have become part of certain modern identities. And so my argument with petro-masculinity is that a certain kind of masculinity, in particular a white sort of Western masculinity, has really depended upon a flow of cheap oil and coal. And in many ways, fossil fuels are important to that identity. And I think it helps us understand the kind of ongoing commitment to fossil fuels, sometimes even in moments where it doesn't even seem rational or economically rational anymore, certainly. We all know it's not rational in terms of climate change, I think, listeners on your show.
Indeed, and concern with climate change is often considered to be on the progressive left of the political dial. But you suggest, in our current structure anyway, worry about climate change could bring more demand for authoritarian solutions. Why?
You know, I really was taken when I read Naomi Klein's book, This Changes Everything, where she points out that in some ways conservatives are right about climate change, when specifically when they say this will change everything. This means, you know, dramatic changes. And I think that that's really frightening. And the problem, especially in the United States, with some of the more centrist or neoliberal parts of the Democratic Party, is I'm not sure that there's yet a recognition of the degree to which climate change poses a threat to the systems, especially capitalist systems. I think this is why you see some of this desire for authoritarianism on the right is a response to what is perceived as a threat to an entire lifestyle, an entire way of life, and all the identities that go along with it. And rather, because of course that's happening alongside climate denial, rather than kind of feel that as the threat is perhaps coming from climate change, something that we could then address through policy, other identity-related threats and also things like global migration become this kind of mounting fear that I think then has to turn to more authoritarian modes of government to secure itself.
Because the caravans are coming or something like that, a fear of the other.
Yeah, the caravans, so there's external, you know, the notion that we have to secure a kind of nation-state border from the quote-unquote outside, but also the sense of an internal threat of, and this is what I talk about in this article about petromasculinity, the way that perceived threats to the gender order coming from trans and queer folks and from feminists can also then contribute to these same sorts of identity threats that might come from climate change, where it's a threat to like fossil fuel systems that have provided or are symbolically associated with this fantasy of the 1950s blue-collar worker.
So this could be a way in which protest movements like Black Lives Matter, Me Too, and climate action all bring about, I was going to say engender, but I hate to use that term in this context, they tie these things together in the minds of a large part of the political population.
Yeah, I think that's right. As we see worse weather or extreme weather events, those can be perceived as threats on par with other kinds of perceived threats to the social system. And I make the case in the article for authoritarianism by thinking about the political psychology of authoritarianism. So there have been a lot of studies by critical theorists since the mid-20th century about what is the psychology of this desire for authoritarianism that's not, you can study historical specific authoritarian regimes, but you can also think about this kind of latent possibility that exists in all of us when there's fear, right? This turn to needing the kind of increased security and rigidity around borders and this kind of increased power or strongman leadership. So one thing that I found interesting in looking at these psychological studies of authoritarianism was that among people who were seen to have a quote-unquote higher score of authoritarian-leaning tendencies, there was this sense of gender anxiety around masculinity, around the need to almost have a hyper-masculinity to kind of respond to a sense of having failed to live up to this notion of strong masculinity. And now when I say masculinity, I don't mean there's one kind of masculinity or it's all men or anything. There's multiple kind of models of what it means to be a man. But there's this particularly dominant one that forms, I think, in modern industrial technological society that we see, especially in the global north, that's related to the flow of cheap oil and coal. My interest was in seeing how I think it's evident to all of us in looking at authoritarian movements that are arising worldwide that there is this kind of threatened masculinity involved. There's a lot of gender anxiety. And I wanted to say that there's a connection between that and fears and concerns about climate change and climate denial. We often think of these as two separate, like almost siloed problems, like different aspects.
Yeah, I remember even in the decades ago, earlier feminism with Betty Friedan argued that advertising was defining the genders and defining women as somebody who would be happy with a new stove in the kitchen and men would be happy with a new pickup truck. And that continues, and it's really hard to avoid as a man not wanting a one-ton diesel pickup truck. So we're in this kind of echo chamber that keeps trying to push us into gender roles, some of which turn out to be really destructive.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that in the same way that especially in this American version of masculinity gets connected with consumption of fossil fuels and the roar of the trucks and, you know, the pickup trucks and all the culture that you're talking about, you have women who consistently associated with the earth and nature, and in that way subordinated, because earth and nature also get subordinated. I was also interested in how I think when we talk about climate denial, there's often an assumption that there's a failure of understanding, or if we could explain it, or if people could see or know it, or maybe if we have enough extreme weather events, the light bulb will go off and people will realize, oh yes, this is a problem. And I think I was interested in showing it's not so much a failure of understanding, it's a failure of understanding how desire is working alongside fossil fuels and energy. And the way that the continued violence of fossil fuels, it's because it's acknowledged that that is very violent, that that might provide this kind of sense of identity expression or release or a performance of this very hyper-masculinity, and not in spite of its violence. You know, so there's kind of like a bursting of what I call the liberal hypocrisy here. And that's what I mean by the centrist notion that, you know, we'll just have a couple little technical changes here and there and everything will be better. And I think that that violence of fossil fuels, you could read that alongside other kinds of gender violence that we see really being celebrated in the far right right now.
And in the halls of the United Nations, delegations talk about the responsibility, who damaged the climate and who should get the remaining resources. But really, when climate slams our cities and the food chains, the developed countries, especially the military, they're planning something else. They want to make it like a fortress where the developed countries will just shut out the real victims and people who were not responsible for climate change.
There is a writer named Christian Parenti who has called this armed lifeboat politics, where the elite and the wealthy are busy building their lifeboats and arming them against others, as opposed to thinking collectively about how to make the earth more inhabitable for more forms of life. And I think I also see this and get concerned with the notion of climate security, where often those who are going to and already are suffering the most from climate change-related disasters and changes are perceived as threats rather than as the most vulnerable, who also were not the most responsible for what's happening. And I also think, relatedly, that the military-industrial complex in the U.S. does not get enough attention, both as a consumer of fossil fuels and also as the protector of a global fossil fuel world, going back, you know, to the 20th century and the long-standing involvement of the U.S. abroad to secure not just the supply of fossil fuels, but kind of secure the market for fossil fuel profits.
And I think the king of petro-masculinity in the United States has to be Charles Koch, the surviving Koch brother. And behind the scenes, this amazingly rich oil man creates false front groups to push his agenda, which is male and ultra-conservative. Does anybody else come to your mind as an icon of petro-men?
Well, Koch is certainly a good one. And, it's interesting. I read somewhere that the Koch brothers make a lot of their money lately on gas futures, so that they're not even really interested in the natural gas itself, but actually buying up little natural gas companies to get the information to then play the market of futures. So there's a lot of work to be done there around studying not just fossil fuels, but the entire financialization of fossil fuels. You know, Trump is an obvious icon. Who else comes to mind?
Well, I think we have to add the kings of the Middle East oil countries, who oversee probably the most anti-women regimes on earth and make their entire livings and their fortunes out of fossil fuels, and they want to see it stay that way.
Right. There's a really interesting history there done by a scholar named Timothy Mitchell, who wrote a fantastic book called Carbon Democracy, and that... In that book, he really connects U.S. foreign policy to the emergence of more extremist groups in the Middle East. And this is related to the authoritarianism argument because Mitchell showed that far from this kind of beacon of democracy spreading around the world, the U.S. actually wanted to encourage many authoritarian groups in, for example, the Middle East, as opposed to more popular and democratic regimes that rose there, and they even, in many cases, sought to destabilize and depose them in favor of more extremist and authoritarian regimes, including in Saudi Arabia. The reason being that it's much easier to control the flow of oil and how much is going to be taken out of the ground and how much is going to be put on the market when you're dealing with authoritarian strongmen, as opposed to a democratic government that is interested in developing energy for its people. So, yes, but I would also add that, again, the U.S. is very instrumental to the emergence of that kind of relationship between masculinity and fossil fuels.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, ecofeminist scholar Dr. Kara Daggett from Virginia Tech. We're talking about petromasculinity and climate change. And along those lines, Kara, it seems to me that almost 99% of climate deniers are older men, usually white men. Do men and women see climate change through different lenses?
I'm very hesitant to say that there's a distinction between men and women in the sense that there's an essentialized difference, that if you're a man, you're prone to one way of thinking, and if you're a woman, you're prone to another way of thinking. And I think in part because if you look at just, for example, the voting returns in the 2016 election, more than half of white women voted for Trump. So I think there are a fair number of women who also espouse those kind of views. Yes, though, to your point, white men make up the most significant proportion of climate deniers, and that is interesting. And I don't think there's anything inherently different between people who identify as men and women. Rather, I think it's the social construction of masculinity and the way that many men may desire or are attached to that kind of identity that explains this. So in other words, I think there are lots of ways that people could be attached to different notions of gender and therefore have different ideas about climate change. And one example would be eco-modern masculinities. This is a kind of masculinity I could also critique, but in this case, you have, you know, someone like Elon Musk, who's really interested in EV and technical solutions to climate, but still, I think, espouses a problematic relationship with both politics and technology that is related to a certain notion of masculinity.
Absolutely. I mean, one petro-masculine approach to the environmental crisis has been a rash of men who want to engineer our way out of this crisis, which is partly designed by engineering, and they want to rebrand big machinery and more production as geoengineering to save the climate. And it seems to me women, we can't generalize, but many women that I've met prefer to work with nature. What is your experience?
I think, again, we have a culture in which masculinity has been associated with STEM fields, with technology, with kind of this notion of rationality and objectivity that I don't think is essential to men, but I do think explains why you see a disparity between, for example, in the field that I work on, in energy, a lot of the policymaking and design of energy and fuel technologies are very male-dominated fields for that reason. In studying feminism, I always say representation is important. It is important to have just the simple fact of more women involved because you will get a diversity of perspectives, but it's not sufficient. It's not everything because, again, women just as easily can embrace these problematic perspectives, and many men can have really ecologically generous identities. So I think what we're seeing when we see more women be more open to ecological thinking in the way that you're describing is an effect of these social constructions of gender and the experiences that women have had as a result of that.
So, Kara Daggett, in your 2018 research article, you write, quote, "Analyzing petromasculinity alerts us to those perilous moments when challenges to fossil-fueled systems, and more broadly, to fossil-soaked lifestyles, become interpreted as challenges to white patriarchal rule." Are we in one of those perilous moments, Kara?
Certainly. I mean, I can't say globally, but to the extent that the U.S. remains important as a major per capita consumer of fossil fuels, I think right now is a pivotal moment in the U.S. where we're seeing the convergence of all of these different forces. And the Trump administration, in many ways, has failed to do a lot of things that it purported to want to do. But it has really succeeded in rolling back environmental regulations and destroying a lot of the environmental framework that what we did have prior, which was insufficient, but you know, to the extent that we had some kind of environmental framework in the U.S., that has gone on in many ways in a sort of quiet background because it is not as spectacular and entertaining as all of the other things that we see every day on Trump's Twitter feed. But I think it's important to recognize the effectiveness of the administration when it comes to promoting fossil fuels and really getting rid of environmental regulations. But that is significant, and it points to the fact that there is a real interest in this kind of anti-environmental policy, even when it's not always getting as much attention, even from the Trump administration. So I think underlying a lot of this unrest really is anxiety about climate change. Even among people who might say they deny it, I think people are recognizing that the system is broken in some way, and however that they want to express it. And certainly that the earth is hurting, I think, is affecting everyone, whether it's being expressed in those words or not.
Totally true. And I also find your writing is, for me, like an index to some leading women thinkers on the convergence of the gender crisis and the climate crisis. We meet people like Kate Mann and Sherilyn MacGregor. Can you talk to us just for a minute about those two people?
Yes, both of them I cite in my work, and they have been very influential to my own thinking. Sherilyn MacGregor is really a leading figure in thinking about climate politics and gender. I actually just heard a talk this morning. She was on a panel about feminist responses to climate change, and she has just done a feminist analysis of Green New Deal policies in the United Kingdom, which is worth checking out. And she really wants to emphasize care work as a central pillar of thinking about the Green New Deal. So I think some of her project in the UK can very much, it has been taken up by others in the US, but really should be when we talk about the Green New Deal in the US. So Kate Mann is a philosopher who is calling us to rethink misogyny. And she says we typically think of misogyny as this sort of individual hatred of women. And then we get really bogged down in trying to prove that some particular person actually hates women or that the intention behind their action was a hatred of women. And she said that this is really unhelpful and means that that concept of misogyny can't really be used because then we always kind of revert to, well, did they actually mean it that way and did they actually believe that? And instead, Mann wants to focus on misogyny as what she calls a policing practice. So she wants to think about not so much the agents of it, but the actions and the effects that it has on women. And her argument is that misogyny is the punishing arm that comes out and punishes gender deviance. It punishes people who are not conforming to the gender norms and the gender rules. And I found this a really helpful concept to think about the way violence works politically. Like, what is it doing? Are we enjoying it? Are we hiding it? Are we justifying it? Are we justifying it and why? And so in my article, Mann doesn't really talk much in her book about misogyny. She doesn't really talk much about environmental politics, which is fine. She's got plenty to do there. But I then think about whether her more capacious concept of misogyny could help us to understand the violence of doubling down and accelerating fossil fuels, which I argue like that the violence of it is the point. And therefore, does it also have this punitive edge to it, this kind of knowing desire to establish or perform power and domination in the way that Mann describes other kinds of misogynistic acts?
Speaking of smart women, I got the idea for this interview from an article by Emily Aitken and her online climate newsletter called Heated, and she wrote about Proud Boys and petro-masculinity. Can you pinpoint any triggers that you see happening now that show a desire for more authoritarianism beyond what Trump himself is trying to claim?
Yes, absolutely. The most telling dimension of this would be the existence of an alternative reality. And I'm not alone. I think many political scientists are pointing this out, that having an alternative set of facts is really a common pattern that you see across other authoritarian regimes. And it's a way to control people easily. And it's also not at all conducive to democracy. So I think that's one problem. And then I think another problem is, you mentioned the Proud Boys. You know, I'll be honest, when I wrote that paper, and it came out in 2018, so I started writing it right after the election. I did some research on the Proud Boys, and Charlottesville had happened. And I wondered, is this going to be a fringe group that they felt relevant to me and they felt representative to me, but I couldn't tell whether that group was going to be replaced by another group or kind of disappear from public attention. I wish it did, but it in fact has only grown, I think, in relevance. And we see Proud Boys and other far-right groups showing up at these protests on the street, being treated with a kind of respect or toleration by police forces. All of these are really worrying signs. I personally, like many, am very concerned about the coming weeks. So yeah, I'm worried.
You and me both. I think a lot of our listeners are deeply concerned about not just the coming weeks, but the period right up into January when there may be a transition of power or may not be.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We return to our conversation with Dr. Kara Daggett, author of Petro-Masculinity, Fossil Fuels and Authoritarian Desire. I think this is a good opportunity to talk about some of your more recent work. And this summer you published Energy and Domination, Contesting the Fossil Myth of Fuel Expansion. And I'm a little puzzled by what you mean by that. What is the myth?
So here I was talking about the stories that we tell about energy, and in particular about energy transitions. And I was recognizing the dominant story, and we talked about eco-modernists. It's very common amongst eco-modernists and also energy scientists and energy policymakers more broadly, is the notion that over human history, not even just modern history, but human history, the way human civilizations have developed vis-a-vis energy is that humans have always wanted more energy. And then technical innovations arrive that provides it. And then they take advantage of it, and the next, you know, the transition occurs. And this, you know, has been read back onto, for example, the transition to agriculture and all of the other energy technologies up into the steam engine, James Watt. And even now, when we think about the next energy transition, there's this notion that there's something about human nature that we're just always hungry for energy, and then we're going to get a better technology that will provide it. And others who really long for a renewable energy transition are worried because they think, well, if that's the case, then this energy transition might be historically unique in the sense that we're talking about new fuel technologies that don't necessarily provide some great acceleration of energy consumption, but rather have other kinds of ecological benefits. And is that, how do we get an energy transition on the basis of that? So I wanted to just recognize that that's a story. There's actually some good historical work to show that hasn't always been the case, especially in some of the major energy transitions that are key focal points of the story. So I look at the transition to agriculture and also the 19th century transition to a coal-powered economy. And in both cases, I look at historical research that shows that it was actually new techniques of political domination that were important to the transition. And it so happened that the particular fuel types that were involved in the transition were better suited to the domination of the many by the few. So in the case of agriculture, it was grains, grain states. And then the case of the transition to a steam-powered economy, it was the difference between using coal versus using water power, which at the time was just as powerful and cost-effective as using coal.
Okay, so let's wrap this up with your new article coming out in October titled Toward Feminist Energy Systems, Why Adding Women and Solar Panels Isn't Enough. What is a feminist energy system?
That question is what what launched that article. And that article is available online if anyone wants to read it. It comes out in print in October. That was written with my colleagues, Shannon Bell and Christine Lebusky, both professors at Virginia Tech. And all of us have done research about gender and energy, and in particular, masculinity and the way that it has blocked a transition to more renewable forms of energy. And I think in the moment of American politics that we're in, we all were interested in thinking constructively, and we asked each other, okay, so if gender is a problem, what would it look like to have feminist energy? And I would say, first and foremost, we believe that that wouldn't look like one single thing, that there would be many feminist energies. But we wanted to start imagining, if you were going to design an energy system, what kind of components would make it more feminist? And so it was exciting to work in collaboration with friends. And we, in that article, look at four dimensions of energy systems: the political, the socio-ecological, the technological, and economic. And we think along each of those dimensions, and really also bringing together lots of eco-feminist work that has been done to try to explain how energy is not just plugging in a new kind of fuel, but is actually a large socio-technical system that structures the way we live our everyday lives and that touches everything from how our houses are designed, where they're situated, how we move around as bodies, how we relate to each other, the division of work in the public and the private. So in many ways, it's trying to kind of further announce and push feminist thinking into what has been a very male-dominated field.
Kara Daggett, where can listeners go to find out more about you and your work?
Well, I have a website, karanewdaggett.com, and you can see all my writing there. And you can also find that website through my Virginia Tech page.
From Virginia Tech, we've been speaking with Assistant Professor Kara Daggett. She researches and writes about ecofeminism, climate, and energy. You can find links to everything we just talked about in my Radio EcoShock show blog published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Kara, thank you for giving your voice in these dangerous times.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
The technology to change the climate of this planet arose in a white, male-dominated society. That's the simple facts. Dr. Jenny C. Stevens is the director of the School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs at Northeastern University. Jenny has been a visiting lecturer at MIT and postdoctoral scholar at the Harvard Kennedy School. Stevens received major research grants from the National Science Foundation and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Now, as America struggles with the public health crisis, the pandemic, back-to-back climate disasters, and protests for racial rights all at the same time, Stevens just published this timely new book, Diversifying Power, Why We Need Anti-Racist Feminist Leadership on Climate and Energy.
Thank you so much. Great to be on the show.
Your new book, Diversifying Power, surprised me. It contains geek-worthy ways to transition society away from killing the climate. You present a really useful chart of front groups created by the infamous Koch brothers. But your voice in this book is not disconnected academic talk. At times, it is revealing about your personal life. Why?
Yeah, so I have been working on climate and energy issues for most of my career, for the past two decades. I've been trained, you know, mostly in kind of the science and engineering of energy and climate. And, you know, as a woman in science, I've been increasingly aware of kind of how the people involved in climate and energy have been contributing to kind of a narrow technocratic lens about climate change that has led us to miss opportunities for investing in social innovation and social justice and social change. I think we've been focusing too much on technological innovation, which is clearly important and part of what needs to happen. But by focusing too much on technology, we have been missing opportunities for change that goes beyond technology and the science of climate change.
Well, let's go to ground with an example from your 2019 co-authored paper, Embodied Energy Injustices, Unveiling and Politicizing the Transboundary Harms of Fossil Fuel Extractivism and Fossil Fuel Supply Chains. You discuss undiscovered impacts from decommissioning a coal-fired power plant in Salem, Massachusetts, and its replacement with a gas-fired station. What did you find there?
So what we found is that all too often we are unaware of the injustices and negative impacts of the energy system that we're reliant on. We still have a very heavily dominant fossil fuel-based energy system, and we need to move away from that to a more renewable-based energy system. And that transformation needs to happen for so many reasons, including some of the social and ecological injustices that are associated with our fossil fuel-based system. So it's not just the burning of fossil fuels that creates greenhouse gas emissions and other toxic that are disproportionately vulnerable and marginalized communities are exposed to, but it's also the transportation and extraction of fossil fuels. And that includes fracking and other mechanisms of mining coal and oil and gas that are also associated with deep negative consequences for the communities in close proximity to those facilities and those procedures, as well as economic injustices. In the book, I highlight the work of Jackie Patterson, who is a leader in environmental justice, working for the NAACP, heading up their climate environmental justice program. And she explicitly focuses on empowering Black communities to resist the influence of the fossil fuel industry. And the fossil fuel industry has oftentimes actually co-opted and manipulated Black communities and other communities to expand their infrastructure in ways that are really devastating to those communities.
Yes, over 10 years ago, I spoke to the executive director of We Act in Harlem, an environmental group, and she was saying just any time there was a new plan by the city to build a garbage dump or a bus terminal, put it in Harlem. The land's cheaper there. The people don't vote for us anyway. Some sort of thinking. And it took a lot of community organization to stop that and make it more fair.
Absolutely. And we are in a situation where we're realizing, especially right now with the pandemic, and we see the racial inequities in healthcare and access to secure housing and jobs, that we have been perpetuating disparities and injustices for a very long time. And I want to bring that back to thinking about economic injustice. So we have had in the United States a widening income and wealth gap just over the past 3 or 4 decades that is actually quite disturbing, and not everybody fully understands how that's connected to climate change. But it actually is, because many of the top 1% who are getting wealthier and wealthier, accumulating power with their wealth, influencing our policies, have been making strategic investments to resist the transformation away from fossil fuels toward more renewable energy. And they've been doing that through a strategic misinformation campaign to deny climate science. They've also been investing in undermining public trust in government and the regulations that are established to protect us, and also minimizing worker protections and worker rights. So some people are increasingly calling the 1%, you know, the polluter elite. They're actually profiting from keeping things the same, the way things are right now, and actually intentionally slowing us down and resisting investments into a renewable-based future that would simultaneously create jobs and other benefits, economic benefits, and for a more prosperous future for everybody.
But it seems even within the movement, many white activists think we need to solve the climate crisis first, or basically die, and then later we can rearrange society for racial and gender equality. Do you see that? And what is your response, Jenny?
So I feel very strongly that the reason we have been so ineffective in addressing the climate crisis is exactly because of that approach, where thinking of these two challenges as separate, and let's prioritize carbon reductions and greenhouse gas emission reductions and decarbonization in a very technocratic way without connecting it explicitly to social justice and racial justice and economic justice. And I think we've been ineffective in that approach. And I call that approach climate isolationism, which is an ineffective way, putting climate as a separate issue that isn't connected with everything else. And what I've done in the book is really elevate stories of really inspiring leaders who have been able to connect the climate crisis with resisting the polluter elite, with jobs and economic justice, with health and food access, and with transportation and housing. And when you connect climate and energy policy with all of the issues that we all are grappling with and need to pay attention to and need to invest in, then you have possibilities for a larger transformation that we really need.
After Hurricane Maria, Donald Trump threw rolls of paper towels to Puerto Ricans who were literally powerless. They were in the dark. Their system had been destroyed by the storm. And in the foreword to your book, Dr. Ted Landsmark points out that big storms like Katrina, Sandy, and Maria brought more people of color toward the environmental dialogue. Can the movement for equality join the climate challenge?
Absolutely. And that's what I actually am inspired and motivated right now. And despite we're in such a hard time right now, so much suffering, so much uncertainty, so much disruption, yet coalitions are building, multiracial, multigenerational. I want to particularly call out the youth movement and the Sunrise Movement led by Barshini Prakash, one of the leaders I mentioned in the book. The Sunrise Movement has really brought together in a collective, inclusive way young people who are concerned both about the climate crisis and about the economic crisis and the jobs that they need in the future. And then connecting that directly with the structural racism in this country and the Black movement for Black lives. And connecting these issues right now is what is happening. And it's actually, as I said, inspiring and can bring us some optimism during this very hard time right now.
Yes, you said you wrote the book because of optimism. And to me, that seems difficult to find because these are dark times. And I'm thinking, too, that people of color are already faced with imminent problems like being targeted or killed by police, being evicted or poverty and homelessness. not everyone, but some. So perhaps a climate crisis developing over decades is a luxury for some people.
Well, I think what we're seeing is that when women and people of color enter into spaces, leadership spaces where they've been historically excluded, they are able to bring a very different life experience and a better sensitivity to these interconnections with social justice and environmental crisis. So I think, again, that's where I see optimism with the, for example, the Squad, the four young congresswomen who have come on the national stage just in the past couple of years and really changed the discourse on so many issues that are and better able to connect climate change and environmental justice issues with jobs, with housing, with transportation. And they've really done so in a very kind of practical, common sense way, thinking about what do people need? What is a people's first approach? And why is it that we have been subsidizing and prioritizing corporate shareholders' interests over what families and workers need in our communities? And so I think that is very refreshing. And that's partly why we need to diversify who's in power so that we can represent different communities, but also so that we can bring this, what I call anti-racist feminist leadership, which is really leadership focused on what people need, people first approach to the table and really anchor and center social justice at the forefront of all of our policies. Because too many of our climate and energy policies are actually exacerbating inequities and disparities because we've provided subsidies that end up benefiting the privileged communities and households and even benefiting the fossil fuel interests. And then we don't have enough investment in ways to make sure that those public investments are distributed to the people who need them the most.
So in my view, there's kind of two key control points for continuing male domination. And the first, which nobody wants to talk about, is religion. Some of them are designed for male-only power. And the second is not really so much government, but control of the financial system, the multi-billionaires, the polluting elite that you talk about, who can come up with the lobby dollars and not buy politicians directly, but finance those expensive campaigns. Should the call for anti-racist feminist action go there first?
Absolutely. The financial system, the economic injustice, the fact that billionaires right now during the pandemic, when we have so much hardship and suffering, are continuing to profit off of everyone else's misfortune is a fundamental flaw, right, that needs to be corrected. And so I think the financial system and redistributing that power that has resulted from a concentration of wealth is fundamental. You mentioned religion, and many faiths are very male-dominated and have historically emerged from a very patriarchal sense of domination and control and leadership. And every faith is also grappling with that, and there are feminist leaders in many, many faiths. So religion evolves with the times, and people are able to continue their faith sometimes by adapting. So I think we want to be very intentional when we talk about religion, about how to reconcile religious traditions with the current understanding of what's needed in society and human rights and dignity for all.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Jenny C. Stevens from Northeastern University in Boston. And we're talking about her new book, Diversifying Power. Jenny, what do you mean by energy democracy?
So energy democracy is a lens, a way to think about the big transformation that we need and that is starting to happen in a way that focuses on people and community. So when with the climate crisis, the biggest piece of what we need to do to minimize the risks of climate change is move away from our fossil fuel dominated system to a renewable based society. And that is a huge shift, but it's much more than just technology shift. What it really is about also is redistributing power literally and figuratively. So what I mean by that is when we think about a renewable based future, it's not just wind and solar. There can be locally and regionally appropriate mix of renewable energy. if a community or a region is on the coast, you could have wave and tidal energy as well as offshore wind. If you're inland, you could have solar and wind. And you could also potentially have geothermal energy, which is another untapped energy source. And the thing with renewable-based society is that once you've figured out how to harness that energy, it's perpetual and it's free and it's abundant. It is revolutionary in a sense. We've limited our discourse about energy to think about, okay, what's the cheapest way to get the energy we need? But we haven't paid enough attention to the possibilities for investing in a renewable-based future that actually provides a very different future where we can have decentralized, locally appropriate control and ownership of our energy system, and we can invest in people and communities in a way that centers social justice and human dignity, and we can leverage the urgency for transformation to actually invest in our communities in new ways. That's what energy democracy is all about. It's both a social movement and a vision for the future.
Along those lines, a new article by David Spratt in Australia calculates that if we try to allocate the last fossil fuels to the people who deserve it most and pollute it least, countries like Canada, Australia, the United States, and Britain would have zero, absolutely zero carbon budget left to spend. Now, it seems unlikely even a supportive population will agree to that, and if not, is climate justice really attainable?
I think it's an opportunity. The challenge before us is big, and it's an opportunity. And if we don't take transformative action to respond to the climate crisis, we are actually going to continue bumbling along the way we have been with increasing costs and disruptions and suffering of all kinds as climate chaos and climate disruptions, whether it be wildfires, hurricanes, flooding, extreme heat, all of these things are going to keep continuing. So we need both mechanisms to prepare ourselves for all of those changes, because some of those changes are already happening and it's going to continue to get worse until we prioritize moving away from fossil fuels and moving toward a more renewable-based future. So yes, it's challenging to envision the scale of change that is needed, but we are clearly right now, particularly in the pandemic, we are realizing that so many things that we thought would just continue along the same as the way they were, it's clear now we're moving into a different phase of kind of humanity's relationship with the earth and our understanding of what we need to do to preserve a positive future for people on planet Earth. So it's a very different time that we're in. And during this disruptive time, I think is particularly important for us to be thinking about how we want to invest in the future and who is going to be prioritized with those investments and how are those going to be distributed.
Talk to us about the example of Mary Robinson in Ireland and at the United Nations.
So Mary Robinson has been an advocate for climate justice with an international lens for decades, really one of the leaders. And she has really advocated for a people-first approach. We need to be thinking about what people need and ensuring that we are making investments for that. I want to connect also with other women leaders around the world, particularly Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, that some of you may have heard about recently. She and the leaders of Germany, Taiwan, Denmark, also countries led by women, are leading the way among the most successful and effective right now in combating the spread of the coronavirus. So during this pandemic, what we're seeing is that these women leaders are taking a very effective approach, and what they're doing is looking at the science and the evidence, making, you know, ambitious, strong, strict decisions, and then they are communicating to the people directly in a way that is empathetic and compassionate why they need to do it and why we need to have a collective vision. It's not just about the health of you and your family, but it's about the collective health of the full community and the country. Similarly, there's been research that shows countries led by more women or have more women in parliamentary systems, for example, have stronger climate policies. And so I think part of what that speaks to is that women bring to their leadership positions a different sense of risk perception and also sometimes a more compassionate and kind of collective vision of how to bring people together. And so I think that is one aspect that is really important when we think about the value of diversifying leadership.
Yes, it's true. We don't have to talk about it theoretically. We can see this in action and the results in various countries. You're calling for anti-racist feminist leadership, but I ask myself, well, how is this really going to happen? Are you picturing social revolution, affirmative action in all fields, action at the ballot box, or what?
I mean, I think it's already happening. And again, that's why my book actually elevates the stories and inspirational, motivational stories of creative, diverse individuals who are doing amazing things. And I think what's happening is we don't all hear about all the leaders that are out there doing great work. We also, many of us are not aware of the coalition building that's happening. Multiracial, multigenerational coalitions are of different movements and activists and advocates are coming together and are ready for a bigger transformation. So I think, you know, here we are a few weeks out of a very obviously critical election. And as we prepare ourselves for the results of that election and the aftermath of the election, we are creating new relationships and coalitions and coming together in some new ways that hasn't really happened before. And what is part of why it's a powerful time is because with the more diverse leadership that we already have, and there's new examples and people joining the movement all the time. Ayanna Presley, my one member of the squad who is my representative here in Massachusetts, she likes to say, anyone who is advocating for a more socially just future is a member of the squad. So it's a very inclusive movement to bring people and encourage and support new leaders to get involved. And when I talk about leadership, we're not just talking about political leaders, elected officials. We're also talking about all of us can be leaders in our communities, in our families, in the organizations that we work for or work with. So we all have opportunities to stand up for what we believe and focus on what do people need and how can we pull back the power of the polluter elite and the billionaires to work toward a transformation toward a more just and sustainable future for all.
Jenny, where can listeners find out more about you and this book?
I'm on Twitter at Jenny C. Stevens, and I also have a website, jennycstevens.com.
We have been speaking with Dr. Jenny C. Stevens, director of the School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs at Northeastern University. Her new book by Island Press is Diversifying Power, Why We Need Anti-Racist Feminist Leadership on Climate and Energy. Find links to follow up in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Jenny, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you so much. Great to be on the show, Alex.
That's it for this week. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.